KBOO Community Radio is proud to welcome the Golden Rule Peace Boat to Portland, Wednesday, June 8th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. In 1958, a crew of Quaker peace activists attempted to sail the Golden Rule to the Marshall Islands to interfere with U.S. nuclear bomb testing. This bold, nonviolent direct action inspired a worldwide movement leading to the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963. On June 8th, there will be a panel presentation and discussion of their past work and plans for a peaceful, sustainable future, featuring Harvey Wasserman of Solartopia, Mimi German of The Radcast, Teresa Rayford from Don't Shoot Portland, and many more. Music will be provided by Dave Rovix. Again, that's the Golden Rule Peace Boat panel discussion on Wednesday, June 8th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Our nation's over-reliance on incarceration has left millions of children emotionally cut off from the most important relationship of their young lives. Join Prison Pipeline on May 30th to hear Laura Speer from the Annie E. Casey Foundation discuss how children of prisoners are impacted and how the states and communities can help support these kids and improve their prospects for success. That's Prison Pipeline, May 30th at 6:30 p.m.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Labor Radio. This is the fifth Monday, and your hosts... two hosts this evening. I am Lane Ponce, the regular host, and with me is Susan Stoner. Good evening, Susan.
Hello. Good to be here.
Glad you're here. It's a very quiet time here at the studio. You and I are going to be hosting together, and we have a lot to say, which is good. We do have one person calling in about his book, Song of the Stubborn 1000, The Watsonville Canning Strike of 1985 through 1987. That is Peter Shapiro. So he'll be calling in, and we'll be interviewing him. We also want to do a review of... Go ahead, tell us about the review.
Recently, there was a labor history conference, and it was put on by the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association. It's a rotating organization in terms of conferences. Washington, British Columbia, and Oregon take turns hosting. We had a great turnout and lots of wonderful workshops.
And one of the workshops that I went to had to do with labor and literature. And I know Ms. Stoner is very familiar with that topic because you have written several books. Why don't you tell us about what's going on with your most recent effort?
Oh, well, my most recent effort has to do with basically centers around women in Portland and how they were trying to improve the civic society, but also get economic justice. And it takes place mostly in a steam laundry, which was one of the few jobs that women could have that actually paid something. It was still far below what men in steam laundry business got paid, but it focuses on that.
Right. And this is what, the sixth in your series of...
Yes.
And your hero is...
Oh, Sage Adair. It's called the Sage Adair Historical Mystery Series, and it takes place in the early 1900s in Portland, Oregon.
Right. And I am proud to say that I've read all of them so far, and I enjoy Sage Adair immensely and the things that you have explored and researched. And we're going to, at the second half of the show, we're going to talk about research and self-publishing and publishing, and I know you're also very familiar with that.
Yes.
Because of your books.
I should say also that part of the inspiration for focusing on a laundry worker strike actually came out of a discussion with you and talking about your grandmother who worked in the steam laundries here in Portland. And now that I've researched it, I am very impressed.
She was not in 1910, however. More, I think probably the 30s and 40s is when she was, but it probably changed very little in that time.
Yeah, you still got steam, you still got heat.
Yeah, and apparently she was, skilled enough that she could move from job to job without any problem. And my mom was telling me just this weekend that they lived right over here on 8th and Burnside in those apartments that have the I think there's a coffee shop down below and apartment houses up. They would live there if she was making good money, and then they would move a little bit further out if her wages were cut. So they were like these mobile people that moved back and forth depending on the work.
It was hard, a hard life for women, especially women who had families that they were supporting.
And she was a single mom with two kids and a dog sometimes. So I think Peter is waiting for us online. Is Mr. Shaparo available?
He is.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Hi, Lane.
Glad to hear you. We were expecting a couple other people, but you came through, so I thank you very much.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let me tell you what your card says. I know you know, but our listeners probably don't. It says that you're a retired letter carrier and longtime labor journalist, that you did a union paper that was repeatedly honored during your tenure as editor, and you've published in Labor Notes, Labor Studies Journal, Unity, and The Nation. Where were you the editor of a union paper?
Oh, I edited the BMIC, which is Portland's own. That's the official organ of Branch 82 of the National Association of Letter Carriers. I edited it for 6 years, up until the time I retired in 2008.
Oh, so that was local.
I was local, yeah. That's actually, it was shortly thereafter, I actually was a host on Labor Radio. I don't know if anybody still remembers. But
I do. I do remember.
You do.
I think we had some meetings once in a while, the collective, right?
Yeah, we did indeed.
We're kind of a loosely associated collective, the labor radio folks, but we managed to show up usually. So now you have since moved away from this area?
I'm in the Bay Area now. I'm living in Oakland. And actually, I should say that at the time, my book deals with a strike that took place in Watsonville, California, which is a small town on the Central California coast. It started in 1985. At the time, I was living in Oakland. I hadn't moved to Portland yet. I was editing the labor news for Unity newspaper, which is a left paper which published until 1990. And we paid very close attention to that strike, and it seemed like nowhere near enough people were paying attention to it, because I think it was one of the most significant labor struggles of the 1980s, and one of the few that was successful against really, really what seemed like overwhelming odds at the time. I thought it was a story that really begged to be told, and I had to wait till I retired from the post office before I had time to do it.
So who was the employer in that?
The employer was actually the largest frozen food plant in the country at the time, and frozen food was, it's hard to fathom now because everybody eats their vegetables fresh, but frozen food was a billion-dollar industry during the Eisenhower era. There were 8 plants in Watsonville. They produced a lion's share of the frozen food that was sold in American supermarkets. Watsonville Canning was the oldest. It was the largest. It had about 1,000 workers, 85% of whom were women, most of them Mexican. There were some who were born in this country, but I think the large majority had come up from Mexico at some point or other. It's been estimated that maybe as many as 50% of them were single mothers.
What were their key demands?
I'm sorry?
What were their key demands? What did they want?
Well, I mean, the strike was really forced on them, and it was an attempt by the owner, a 37-year-old law school dropout named Mort Consul, to pretty much drive the union out of the plant and get a competitive advantage get an advantage on his competitors, all of whom were covered by a master agreement with the Teamsters Union. He basically wanted to cut their wages from $6.66 an hour down to $4.65. He wanted to eviscerate the health benefits. I mean, in the 2 or 3 months prior to the strike, there was a murderous speed up in the plants, where veteran workers were unable to keep up. People were being fired right and left. And it was obvious that the owner of the plant was doing everything he could to provoke a strike. So it wasn't so much a case of the workers making demands as they're just simply fighting for their jobs and their union. The union, unfortunately, at the time was a Teamsters local, which had delivered pretty good contracts up until the early 1980s, mainly because the industry was growing so fast that there was a huge labor shortage. And the head of the union, who was a gentleman named Richard King, had pretty much ran it as a one-man show ever since the 1950s. He was friends with most of the owners of the frozen food plants. The owner of Watsonville Canning actually was was his godson, and he was completely flabbergasted when Mort Consul suddenly decided to drive the union out of the plant. He was totally unprepared to deal with the situation. The union was largely dysfunctional. Richard King was, it's probably fair to say that he was pretty much alcoholic at that point. He didn't speak a word of Spanish. He rarely showed up for union meetings. The union simply wasn't functioning, and here they were facing, you know, this existential crisis.
So was the owner of the plant that triggered all this, was he like new on the job? Had he just taken over?
He had inherited the plant from his father, who pretty much built the business up from scratch beginning in the 1940s, and who had signed with the Teamsters fairly early on. You know, I think it was 1948 when he signed his first contract. He died, I believe it was in the, well, let's see, I'm not sure exactly when it was, but it was in the early 70s. His son dropped out of law school, took over the plant, and pretty much ran the show as a family business until he got the idea in his head, for reasons I couldn't testify with any complete certainty, that he could drive the union out.
Well, wasn't that a period of time when sort of the whole Reagan mentality was sort of sweeping corporate America?
And what he did was he went to the biggest union law busting law firm in the country, Little or Mendelson, Fastiff and Tisch,
who are still around doing the same thing.
Yeah. They had been doing that all over the country. They pretty much started a whole cottage industry of providing legal help to employers who want to get rid of unions. And the strategy basically was to force the unions out on strike, stonewall in negotiations, keep them out for 12 months, at which point under the National Labor Relations Act, the strike-breaking employees are entitled to call for a union election and decertify the union. That was his strategy, and that was what he hoped to do. If that didn't happen, he thought, well, at least the workers, the striking workers will get scared and go back to work and work for whatever I, you know, say they can get.
So kind of blackmail.
Yeah.
So you said that ultimately, though, the strike was won. How come it was won?
Well, I think the most important, there were a bunch of things that contributed to its success, but I think the most important thing is that not one of those 1,000 workers are out on strike crossed the picket line, not once during the course of 18 months.
Why do you think that is? That's extremely unusual.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that their capacity for self-organization, the fact that they looked out for each other, the fact that they had built up a very close bond working together in that plant for many years, the fact that almost all of them lived in Watsonville. This was the oldest plant in town, and almost all of the workers had been recruited locally. Some of the competing businesses had to recruit from outside of Watsonville, but anybody from Watsonville who went back to work across the picket line would just face the the wrath of his or her neighbors. And I also think that, you know, they won a huge victory 11 months into the strike, and I think this was really key. The Teamsters local 912, was pretty much falling apart when the strike began. The strikers, after about 3 weeks into the strike, they called a meeting. They elected their own strikers committee, which pretty much took on a lot of the responsibilities that the union should have been taking on. You know, running the food bank and administering the strike fund. The union had no strike fund when it began, so they started their own, you know, ad hoc operation. They would, you know, keep tabs on the scabs. One of the things they did, which was to prove very important later in the strike, a lot of people had to leave town. There were dozens and dozens of families evicted from their homes. Some of them went to the San Joaquin Valley to follow the crops. It, you know, the thing about frozen food work is it was considered a step up from work in the fields. A lot of those people had been farm workers. The advantage of working in a frozen food plant is it was steady work. You made a union wage. You could settle down. Your kids could go to school year-round. You might be able to save enough to buy a house or at least, you know, rent a place that was big enough for, you know, your family. And a lot of them during the strike went back to working in the fields.
You know, I have wondered whether there isn't also a sort of a cultural sophistication in folks that were raised in Mexico in the sense that they had Zapata, they had a revolution in 1910 that talked about, was essentially a class kind of analysis of what was going on there. And I'm wondering whether you considered or came to see any connection between sort of their cultural heritage and their ability to stay cohesive.
Well, there's no question there was a strong kind of a national identity at work there. They came to see themselves as kind of carrying the banner for the Latino movement in this country. But as far as the Mexican influence is concerned, it's an interesting question because one of the things that one of the strikers I interviewed said was, you know, thing is, in Mexico, unions are a male affair. The women are expected to sort of stay out of it. Some of the most militant strikers and militant members of Local 912 were men, and they were the ones, I think, who kind of initially formed a chapter of Teamsters for a Democratic Union in Local 912 and tried to kind of get the local on track before the strike. But they were only a small minority of the strikers, and a lot of them kind of took a dim view of the women taking so much leadership. It was, you know, it's anybody who's seen the movie Salt of the Earth probably recognizes the pattern.
Yes, it's a wonderful movie. Highly recommend everybody see it. It's very,
I mean,
very heartwarming.
I don't know if you can get it on Netflix, but if you've never seen it, you should.
Hey, Peter, let me say that we're happy to have you with us, and we're wondering, the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about publishing and research. Would you mind staying with us and carrying on that conversation?
Sure.
Okay, and for now, the book that you're, is it soon to be published or is it already out? The name of
it
is?
No, it'll be out in September. Haymarket Books is bringing it out, and actually you can go to their website if you want to order it in advance. I mean, I there's no way I could, it was a tremendously complex strike, and it's the kind of story you could talk about for hours, and there's no way you can do justice to it in a short interview. So
and the name
you
of the
narrative from the book.
And the name of the book is Song of the Stubborn 1000.
That's
and
correct, which is actually
Watson...
borrowed from the title of a corrido that one of the strikers wrote after the strike was over.
And it's the Watsonville Canning strike of 1985 through 1987, and we're talking with Peter Shaparo. So what kind of research did you start up with when you got this idea to write the book?
Well, you know, I did some basic research when I was still up in Portland on, you know, the frozen food industry and the history of the Teamsters Union and how, you know, their role in the California food processing industry, which is a hugely interesting story and one that historian Vicky Ruiz has written about and also Patricia Zavea. But mainly, I went down to Watsonville. I was able to locate, you know, a number of the strikers, the old retired head of Local 912 who took office after Richard King was pretty much forced out by the strikers. His name is Sergio Lopez. I also, there's at San Francisco State University in the Labor History Archives, there's a wealth of strike material. Frank Bardicky, who was an old transplanted Berkeley radical who moved to Watsonville and helped start their TDU chapter, has a huge file there. But also Teamsters Joint Council 7, which is all the Teamster locals in Northern California, their head, Chuck Mack, retired while I was working on the book and basically donated all his papers to that library, and there's a whole box of papers on the Watsonville strike.
So your research...
It's there for anybody who wants to look at it.
Your research was, in a way, easier because you had actual interviewees that were from the era. Now, Susan's done a lot of research on her books that take place in 1910. So, Susan, how does that compare with doing something where you can interview people and have live feedback?
Well, I think you're more limited. I do a lot of reading of old letters and newspapers, books, that, contemporaneous books that were written at the time. It's harder to sort of get all the various aspects. But then I'm doing fiction, so I can fill in holes with my imagination, whereas what Peter's doing is more difficult, I think, because he's got to be, especially since the people are still alive,
yes.
He can't make errors because there'll be somebody there to snap his suspenders, so to speak.
Oh, you better believe it.
Yeah.
Well,
so you had said, you didn't quite finish, just briefly, you said that they won. What did they win? Did they go back to work? Did their boss change?
They went back to work. They kept the union. They wound up having to take a wage cut, but they drove the owner of the plant out of business. He had to basically, Wells Fargo Bank had been financing him. He started off the strike with an $18 million line of credit from the bank. The Teamsters International got interested enough in the strike that they threatened to take all their money, all their funds, out of Wells Fargo accounts. But the turning point was really that after 11 and a half months, the strikers themselves petitioned for an election, a certification election, because there had never been a union election in that plant, you know, to certify it as a bargaining agent.
So the strikers
had a right to petition for an election before the 12 months were up, and they were allowed to vote. Now, at that point, they were scattered all over the map. Some of them had gone back to Mexico to wait out the strike. They all came back to Watsonville on the day of the vote to cast their ballots. And even though the owner of the plant, Mort Consul, had gone on a hiring binge in the couple of weeks leading up to the vote and had probably twice as many people as he needed in the plant, the strikers were still able to cast more ballots in favor of keeping the union. And at that point, Wells Fargo cut Mort Consul off, and he wound up having to sell the plant to a local grower to whom he owed $5 million for broccoli that he had never paid for. The grower realized that was the only way he was going to get his money back is by buying the plant himself and settling with the union, and he did.
Was the outcome like 3 years after that good? I mean, were people satisfied with the new owner?
Well, you know, he was willing to work with the union. I think, you know, the struggle continued in the plant. Unfortunately, what happened was that the frozen food industry was starting to decline. And then I think Bill Clinton drove the final nail in the coffin when he pushed the North American Free Trade Agreement through Congress, at which point the whole industry pretty much migrated to Mexico. And there are there's only a handful of frozen food plants in Watsonville now, and they're much smaller.
Wow, but, that's pretty interesting.
The people who participated in the strike are still there. They're still around. They still talk about it. It's still important to them.
Great.
Wow. We have a frozen food business here in the Valley that's a co-op. Isn't that Flavor Pack? I think it's some kind of a farmer-owned co-op.
And I think
they do
right.
a lot of frozen
South
food.
South of Wilson, Woodburn.
Right, right. Mm. So they're kind of hanging in there, but that's a different kind of, you know, it's co-op. It's not unionized and that sort of thing. So, Well, Peter, that sounds like you did a lot of work digging up a lot of information and trying to be as factual as possible, where, as we know, Susan can make up things as she goes along, which makes it most entertaining. So, Susan, tell me about...
It's a hell of a lot of fun to read her stuff. I hope it's at least half as much fun to read mine.
Oh, we'll see. We'll see. But, Susan, why don't you tell us about how you go about publishing your work? Because one thing we learned at the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association is that people that write books that have to do with labor and people's working lives are many times just, they're not considered interesting enough, and so they don't really get a lot of publicity and they kind of fall to the wayside.
Well, usually what the problem is with publishing companies is it's not something that they have expertise in selling. And so it's difficult to find a publisher unless it's something like Haymarket. And I think Haymarket probably specializes more in nonfiction than fiction. And fiction is always harder to place. What happened with us is that we weren't able to find a publisher, and then we started researching self-publishing and the whole publishing industry, and discovered that it was undergoing a horrific, from the author's point of view, transformation, where even the major, first of all, it was consolidating like from 100 publishing companies to 18, I think, at the time. And the other thing is they weren't putting any money towards marketing your books, and but they maintained all the control and took most of the money. And so we started researching, and we thought, well, this self-publishing stuff sounds interesting, and it was on its way out, or up, I should say. And so we kind of decided we were going to do that, and lo and behold, a big publisher actually sent a contract and said, yeah, we'd like to have your books. But then I read the contract, and it was basically indentured servitude for the rest of my life. I had to promise to give them all my books, and, you know, and it just, what we would make off the books was just minuscule. And we had to do all the marketing, but they got to control how we marketed. So we had to pay for it, but they got to control.
Is this anyway. How the rich get rich and the poor get poor?
Oh, yeah. So because of that, we went the self-publishing route. And it has its problems, but it is nice to really basically be in control. And you do get to save, or you do get a lot more of the money that comes when you do sell the book. And that's a good thing too. So.
And so, Peter, how did you get hooked up with this Haymarket?
Well, I mean, I was actually recommended them by Steve Early, who is a veteran labor journalist. He read my manuscript and liked it, and he said, don't fool around with the academic publishers. They'll just mess you over. The one academic publisher I did go to on my own did mess me over. I won't mention any names.
Good.
But Haymarket is a movement operation. I actually think their big seller is Noam Chomsky.
Oh.
And, you know, I didn't write this book with any expectation of making money off of it. I mean, I've got my post office pension, and that's enough for my modest needs. But I do hope they make back their investment, because I think they deserve it. And they publish a lot of good stuff that deserves support, and I'm glad that there's still a publisher out there that will put this kind of thing into print and circulate it, you know, and that won't treat you like an indentured servant.
Well,
at least they haven't done that to me yet, and I don't expect them to.
You know, I'm kind of with you, Peter. I never went into this because I thought I was going to make money. I wanted to tell stories, and I wanted to bring people's own history to them because I thought it would empower them. And I suspect that a lot of people in our shoes, that's what we're motivated by. We don't really sit around dreaming of being the next Jackie Collins or whoever, or Stephen King or whoever it is that, you know.
Yeah.
Makes a ton of money.
Well, and you both come from backgrounds, union backgrounds, where you worked full-time most of your lifetime, right? And
yep.
It's just now that you have a little more time to delve into these sort of things. So that's good. We like to see that. So,
Susan, actually, I appreciate the fact that, you know, I mean, I love to read good fiction, and it's getting harder and harder to come by. And I imagine it's harder and harder for people who are in a living writing it. I'm realizing that a couple of generations ago, you know, it was very common for, like, people, for instance, who were newspaper reporters or print journalists to sort of write a novel on the side and, you know, and produce something that was worth reading. I mean, I'm curious as to how you look at that whole phenomenon about how tough it is to get fiction out there now.
It's, you know, I think if you've just got to have small goals, and I see it as an opportunity to talk to people about things they love and I love. People really connect with the idea of these are stories about people like their grandparents and what their grandparents went through. So I think it's sad that there seems to be a real cookie cutter kind of approach. The big publishing companies anymore are definitely looking for the next Stephen King, the next, you know, they aren't very brave anymore. So it's tough for a writer, but the ebook stuff is starting to take off too, and I think that's a little easier for authors to be heard.
Hey, guess what, you guys? We made it through a half an hour program. Thank you both very much. It's been very informative, and I've enjoyed my time here, and I hope our listeners have. We've been talking with Peter Shaparo, whose book, Song of the Stubborn 1000, will be coming out in September, and my co-host, Susan Stoner, who has written many novels, all featuring, well, not all of them featuring Portland, but the majority have some connection with Portland in 1910. 1903. Thank you. So, and one of the things I really liked about your book was the one about the bridges.
Uh-huh.
Because now you go across Sullivan's Gulch without even thinking you're on a bridge, and that there were so many connectors between East and West Side. And now we just kind of take it for granted. It's either a major bridge or not.
Yeah.
So, That was nice. It was very informative. So thank you both. And Labor Radio will be back again next Monday at 6 o'clock to 6:30. And we thank our listeners for tuning in. And we'll see you again. Good night.
Thank you, Lane.
Thank you all both.
Bye-bye.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. My guest is Laura Speer, Associate Director for Policy Reform Advocacy at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Over 5 million children nationwide have had an incarcerated parent. The loss of a parent through incarceration can have lasting effects on a child's development and well-being. In April 2016, the Annie E. Casey Foundation proposed recommendations for state and local policymakers to help kids nationwide who struggle as a result of having an incarcerated